Dripping in diamonds, shimmering in silks, movie stars of the 1930s and 40s dazzled on the silver screen. Some of their costumes and jewels are now on view at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg wore sturdy black Oxfords as she toured the exhibit.
Oh, there's Clark Gable. And who's he talking to?
He is talking to Carol Lombard.
A film clip runs on a wall behind gorgeously gowned mannequins lit by sconces and chandeliers. The film is No Man of Her Own, 1932, starring the guy who would become Rhett Butler and the beautiful blonde comedian.
What kind of book do you want?
I don't know. What could you suggest?
Well, there's poetry.
Well...
A drama?
No.
Fiction?
No.
Well, would you like Shakespeare?
Oh, Shakespeare's all right, but you know how it is. Some nights you just don't feel like Shakespeare.
Near the film clip, Boston curator Michelle Finnemore shows the actual gown Lombard wore. Long, slinky silk crepe covered in teeny gold glass beads.
I felt like we needed at least one completely bugle beaded dress in the show because it's a very Hollywood style.
What's a Hollywood
adornment
show without bugle
exactly,
beads?
Exactly, you need bugle beads.
Stars of Hollywood's golden age were dressed like goddesses in beads and sequins and luxurious materials.
A lot of French fabrics that are silver with metal wrapped threads, and the metal is silver and then it's actually gold plated on top of it. So it's almost like they're wearing jewelry because they're actually enrobed in this metal.
In black and white films, the fabrics gave off a sheen. They gleamed and shimmered. In the early 1930s, when clunky microphones picked up every passing sound, those fancy fabrics had to be seen but not heard.
There's a lot of velvets, satins, lamés, and there is a lot of silk and chiffon, which are very quiet fabrics.
I'm pleased to meet you.
Oh, he informs me you're keeping a diary.
Oh, yes. My motto is keep a diary and someday it'll keep you.
Mae West was a vamp. With her curves and wriggles, she was the 30s version of Marilyn Monroe. She's represented in the Boston show by a surprisingly high-necked purple Schiaparelli gown that shrouds two of her best features. Of course, there is a flowering vine that snakes up her body from hem to neck. Curator Emily Storer says Mae West, a major star, was petite.
We've read varying accounts of how tall Mae West was. She was between 4'11 and 5'2.
On screen, she looked larger than life. Now we know why. She wore shoes that made her 8.5 inches taller. A feat of foot engineering. Each shoe has two layers. On top, white platform shoes with ankle straps. Built right underneath them, silver pumps made of wood.
Under a long dress, you wouldn't notice that these shoes were being worn. These silver toes would just peep out through the hem of the dress.
Mae West is said to have worn them all the time, on screen and off. Her jewelry was also larger than life, a ring, pin, and bracelet made of massive aquamarines and diamonds.
And she, of course, would have worn them all together and likely with other jewels as well.
Stars used their own jewelry in films. It showed off their wealth and power. A spiffy sapphire and diamond necklace, a gold bracelet so big it would protect you in a dark alley. More restrained, Joan Crawford's suite of jewelry, a matching necklace, bracelet, and pin of gold, diamonds, and aquamarines. On or off screen, it was always important for her to look glamorous.
Joan Crawford once said, "I never go out of the house unless I look like Joan Crawford, the movie star. If you want the girl next door, go next door."
Better to go to Boston if you can. The Museum of Fine Arts exhibition Hollywood Glamour runs through early March. Clothes and jewels from the days before Manola Blahnik shoes hit the red carpets, days when the dazzle was on the big silver screen. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And you can see some of that dazzle at NPR.org.
This is Fresh Air. The TV series Batman has been released on home video for the first time since it premiered in the 60s. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, watched it the first time around and is very, very happy to see it finally come out on DVD.
If you're an impressionable young kid hitting your teens right now, chances are pretty good you've been watching and enjoying some Batman. Either Christian Bale and Christopher Nolan's just completed Dark Knight trilogy, or the prequel series Gotham, now showing on Fox. If you came of age a generation ago, your Batman of choice was likely to have been the big-screen Caped Crusader played by Michael Keaton or George Clooney, or maybe even Val Kilmer. But between 1966 and 1968, long before any of those versions of the DC Comics hero, Batman came to the screen in a much lighter and brighter ABC series starring Adam West. The Dark Knight, it wasn't. This Batman was played for laughs, with its star's no-nonsense delivery making it all the more tongue-in-cheek. With its pop art sensibility, vibrant colors, and rogues gallery of playful guest stars, Batman was a brief but major hit. Frank Gorshin as the Riddler, Cesar Romero as the Joker, Burgess Meredith as the Penguin, and Julie Newmar as Catwoman. These were some of the original villains who made this Batman a TV phenomenon right from the start. That first season, ABC presented 2 episodes per week in a serialized cliffhanger format, and both installments made that year's top 10. Yet until now, this particular incarnation of Batman has never been released on home video. Not on DVD, not even on VHS. But Warner Brothers Home Video has just released the entire Adam West Batman series on DVD and Blu-ray, including a limited edition collectible box set that comes with a set of Batman trading cards and even a Hot Wheels Batmobile. Some collectors, I guess, will geek out over all that extra stuff. But personally, I love the extras that come on the bonus disc. Like the original screen test of Burt Ward, who won the role of Robin, and the original pilot for a planned Batgirl spin-off, and a new documentary which has various Batman experts placing the TV series squarely in the pop art movement of the mid-60s.
Batman 66, was it not just mimicking the comic book, but mimicking the mimicker of the comic books? Roy Lichtenstein was doing these paintings where he was literally painting a comic book panel and enlarging it and showing the sound effects.
What Lichtenstein did was bring the general, originally art world, and then the general public to an awareness factor of the value of comics and comic art.
Dozier's team looked at that phenomenon of what was going on, and they said, okay, so he's taking this from comics and he's making it cool, he's making it mainstream. How do we go full circle? How do we bring that back? And how do we take that pop art sensibility and bring that to this incarnation of comics and make it work in a non-print medium? And they used the sound effects, they used the cartoon style title, all those visual elements to bring you into it, and then brought it to life with the color and the costuming and the production design.
Most of all, of course, I love these old Batman episodes themselves. Certainly, that goes for the classics, like the ones with the original Catwoman and those pop art fight scenes.
You feline devil! What have you done with Robin?
Aw, is that any way to greet an old friend, Batman? Not even a hello, how are you? Teach him some manners, fellas.
But to be honest, I also enjoy watching the really obscure, justifiably forgotten, admittedly bad ones. Who remembers Zsa Zsa Gabor as Minerva, or Ida Lupino as Dr. Cassandra? I didn't. But I do remember Joan Collins, in a pre-Dynasty role at her most alluring, playing the seductive villainess known as the Siren. Her high-pitched, mini-skirted spell worked well, and not just on Commissioner Gordon.
A glorious morning in Gotham City, but in Commissioner Gordon's office, the Siren readies a nasty scheme.
Now, Commissioner, you are ready to do my bidding.
Your merest wish is my ultimate command.
Just say yes, that will be sufficient, although superfluous. No man can resist the stunning note of my voice, 2 octaves above high C.
I remember the Siren, and especially Catwoman, very fondly indeed. Various rights issues have kept Batman from home video release until now, so younger viewers, those seeing this goofy, playful comic book TV version for the first time, may be very pleasantly surprised by the fun to be had here. And for fans of a certain age, who are old enough to remember the 60s, I'm fairly certain this long-delayed box set will be worth the wait. Holy sensory overload, Batman.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and has curated an exhibition on the history of television, which is on view at the Apex Art Gallery in New York through December 20th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Welcome to the Small Batch edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Glenn Weldon, who writes about books and comic books for NPR. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
Well, this week, Glenn and I are here because of the return of a show that he was already a big fan of, and I have recently become a big fan of, called The Comeback. Now, Glenn, do you want to talk a little bit about the history of The Comeback?
Sure. In its first season, which was back in 2005, I think, Lisa Kudrow plays Valerie Cherish, an out-of-work actress who is willfully and indefatigably optimistic, and she is desperate to be loved and respected, and she is eternally attempting and failing to control how others perceive her. So the lens that we meet her through is this fake reality television show that is tracking her as she goes to audition for a terrible sitcom called Room and Board. She gets the part.
B-O-R-E-D.
B-O-R-E-D. See what they did there? And she gets the part, and she is proceeded to be dealt a series of humiliations that she just bucks up under because she will just sell out her own dignity, no matter how indignant she gets. That's the plot of the first season. The second season, which just returned, has one of the head writers writing a show based on that experience that she then auditions for and gets the part that she played back on the original show. It's incredibly meta and three levels deep, but that's pretty much it.
It is. I think my take on this show was always this was kind of the comedy about a terrible person, like some of the kind of David Brent on The British Office and Curb Your Enthusiasm and stuff like that, where you were asked to follow just a really unpleasant, sort of morally vacant person. And even Seinfeld is like that in a lot of ways. What's remarkable about it is how human she is, that she is not at all a terrible person. She is a person who has been bent and damaged by spending all of this time in this bent and damaging system. And legitimately, she wants to be good at what she does. And she sees all of these humiliations and all of this celebrity behavior. She sees all of this as, you know, this is a way to get back to doing what I want to be doing, which is being funny. Whether or not you think she's funny, that's what her thinking is.
The reason the show isn't depressing, because if it was nothing more than here's the chronicle of a woman, a middle-aged actress in Hollywood, and this great infrastructure, which is keeping her down, and look at what depths she'll sink. If it was just that, it would be a depressing show. And it is a little bit about that. Mostly, it's about this performance by Lisa Kudrow and this viewpoint. This show is rigorously fair to her, which is a lot of these other shows that have a pathetic, cringe-inducing main character isn't. Because when something bad happens to her, it's not like she's clueless. She's a very shrewd character. And Kudrow lets you see in Valerie's eyes the fact that it happened, that she registers it, and then she shows us her first reaction, which is to make sure nobody else sees that it's registering how damaged she's just gotten. It's also fair to her in another sense, because it does give her moments of victory. Now, they're mediated and they're not big, but it does give her these passing moments of victory. And it also shows that she is completely complicit in all the bad crap that happens to her. Everything she does is a choice. And there are people surrounding her, loving people, telling her, no way, this is dumb. Why are you doing this to yourself? And she continues to do it. That's fair. And that's why it's not ultimately depressing.
Right. There are a lot of people who, when they talk about show business and when they talk about Hollywood, they kind of envision it as a bunch of bad, vacuous, soulless people doing bad, vacuous, soulless work, which I always think is actually too chipper of a, too cheery of a way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it actually is a lot of very originally, very nice, very normal, very relatable people that you would like if you met them and talked to them, who spend a lot of time in this system and wind up really having to make a lot of these painful compromises. And that's what's painful about a lot of this stuff. If it were somebody who was a bad person,
mm-hmm.
in whom you could see nothing human, then who cares what compromises they're making? You know,
right.
then it's just a pit of vipers.
Right.
And I think what gives it some depth and some humanity is the fact that in there is a person, you can tell. And at least she has the capacity to be a good person, but she's in this horrible situation.
Well, let's speak about bad people. Let's speak about Pauly G, the villain of the piece, who is the worst character on television today.
I think that's right.
Okay. Pauly G plays the, he was a showrunner of this terrible sitcom, and he's also the showrunner and chief writer of this new show that she's going on in this
yeah.
second season.
And Pauly G, remember, is a character on the show, but the show is a fake reality show. So he exists in Valerie Cherish's reality.
Yeah. He's a very specific Hollywood type. He's a cynical comedy writer of the dude bro variety. It's the backward baseball cap. He is the face of the sort of lazy hostility of entitlement.
Yes.
This kind of reflexive hostility that's omnidirectional because he's a damaged person, but also because this is, I do not think it is a coincidence that a show created by a woman and a gay dude, when they want to make you see what Hollywood is like, what a Hollywood writer's room is like,
yeah.
this guy is the guy they choose.
Yeah.
There's a Pauly G in every writer's room. Sometimes Pauly G is running the writer's room.
Mm-hmm.
It's not broad. It's very specific. And we get a very specific idea of who this guy is
yeah.
and why, even a little bit of why he's like he is.
Yeah. One of the things I love about the show is that it's so smart about show business. It's a great satire of show business and a great satire of the making of sitcoms. What it isn't is much of a satire of reality shows.
No.
And the reason for that became
Right. But it's
not. The reason for that became very clear to me when I started reading interviews with Lisa Kudrow, who clearly doesn't watch reality television.
No.
Its treatment of reality shows is the 2005 idea of people who hadn't been watching reality shows and thought it was all people eating bugs and
right.
who think, you know, she made a comment recently where she was like, well, these shows like Fear Factor and The Amazing Race. And I was like, wait, those aren't the same thing. What are you talking about? But people who lump everything together. So you don't really get a satire of reality shows. And there's nothing in here that makes me think like, boy, they have really skewered the reality, even the celebrity reality world.
This show is so much about how she is attempting to control how people perceive her. And so when you want to make a show about that, the vehicle you use is fake reality show. And the meat of the first season is the relationship that develops between her and the unseen producer named Jane. That relationship is a huge part of it, which
yeah.
is ostensibly a reality television gimmick that they've just kind of turned up the volume on.
The other thing that I like about the show is that in addition to her being very human, there are some interesting choices made about other characters on that show, particularly the young actress who is played by Malin Ackerman,
yep.
who in the first season could so easily be kind of the obvious, mean, vacuous, blonde starlet stealing all the attention, gradually becoming more and more vain as the season goes along because she's the one who sort of is the breakout star. It's not like that at all.
Yep.
She's actually a pretty nice person. There is an uncomfortable kind of patronizing way in which she's very nice to Valerie, and you get a sense of a very Hollywood thing that I don't always think gets enough attention, which is how people come to not trust other people being nice
mm-hmm.
because everyone is kind of so kiss, and, mm-hmm. and you start to lose your grip on what it means when people are nice to you. There's a wonderful kind of tension in that character who so easily could have been a total throwaway.
Right. Absolutely.
At any rate, I enjoyed it very, very, very much. I'm very glad it's back.
It's great.
Really good. Again, The Comeback, airing Sunday nights on HBO, starring Lisa Kudrow and a bunch of other people who are pretty terrific as well.
Pretty much everybody comes back for the second season.
Yeah, pretty much everybody. So full episodes of Pop Culture Happy Hour are available every Friday on iTunes or from your favorite podcast provider or at npr.org. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you, Linda.
Welcome to the Small Batch edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson, who's a writer and editor with NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Well, we have news today of the death on Wednesday of prolific and versatile director Mike Nichols, who died at the age of 83 after a long and varied career. So Stephen and I wanted to spend a little time talking about the work of Mike Nichols, which we both have varying attachments to, I think, for different reasons.
Yeah, I was really hit hard by the death of Mike Nichols. I certainly loved a lot of his films. There were certainly many to choose from. Everything from, you know, The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf into, you know, this string of huge hits in the 80s and 90s, like Working Girl and The Birdcage.
He was a very prolific guy.
Yeah, and I certainly loved a number of those films, but for me, the most personal attachment to Nichols's work was his work as a comedian with Elaine May. Mm-hmm. When people talk about, you know, the great comedians of the kind of the middle of the 20th century, and they, you know, they're immediately talking about these great records by Bob Newhart and Richard Pryor and the Smothers Brothers and Woody Allen and all these great stand-ups, mm-hmm. you know, of that era. And I think that for some reason Nichols and May don't always get the credit that they deserve.
The one that I was watching this morning that I know is one that you like I was watching a performance of it on the Jack Parr Show.
Oh, yeah.
Where they were doing this bit about this, well, she calls herself the Grief Lady.
The Grief Lady sketch is actually woven deeply into the fabric of my family's, you know, just my family history. It's a bittersweet story, but basically they have this sketch where Elaine May is selling caskets.
Welcome to Long Dust. Can I help you?
Yes. I read your ad. I'm interested in the $65 funeral.
Was that for yourself?
And Mike Nichols is the grieving, he's the grief-stricken loved one, but he's also trying to get out of this on the cheap.
Yeah.
And he's largely a straight man. He's largely he's just lobbing the ball up in the air for her to slam through the net.
Before you go, Mr. Mazofreen, I was just wondering, would you be interested in some extras for the loved one?
What kind of extras?
Well, how about a casket?
He's wonderfully in character, but also trying not to break mm-hmm. because she's so funny. And when my father died about 20 years ago, my mom and sister and I were in the funeral home shopping for caskets, which is this incredibly morbid and frustrating, just an aggravating task because they're constantly trying to upsell you and it's awful. And the funeral director leaves the room and the three of us are walking around and my mom recites that routine basically from memory.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind, she's reciting it from memory from having seen it on the Jack Parr Show 30 years earlier.
Yeah.
This was before YouTube. This was before...
It wasn't on any of their albums at the time, I don't think.
It wasn't on any of their albums. And so it wasn't until years, you know, later that I was able to obtain a copy of it, you know, to share. But she did it remarkably well from memory. And so we're walking through the funeral home as my mom is reciting this bit and we're falling over laughing. I'm sure the funeral director has seen all sorts of emotional
right.
responses, but it was like, what is wrong with these people? it was, you know, that was great. But I mean, the language that I share with my mother, you know, not only that, but the phone call home to mother,
mm-hmm.
again, where Elaine May is the incredibly emotionally manipulative mother,
yeah.
and he's like a rocket scientist, but she's still sort of disappointed in him.
Yeah. You know, I think when you tell that story, one of the things I like about that story, and one of the reasons I think it's important to talking about somebody like Mike Nichols, is that You know, people who come out of comedy and people who do a certain amount of comedic work leave legacies that are just as profound and important and special to people as anybody who kind of is doing the most serious and the most instantly recognized as the highest of art. And certainly in his film directing, he never had any difficulty being recognized as a great artist. He directed The Graduate, as you said. He directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He came to those things out of directing theater. He directed the original productions of a couple of really important Neil Simon plays. He directed the original productions of Barefoot in the Park and The Odd Couple.
Well, and he's an early Second City guy.
Yeah. And so to me, one of the things that I always notice about his stuff, and I think it's true if you go up, you know, from The Graduate all the way up through Working Girl, you get this kind of tension between that there is always kind of the positive side of the story, and then there is always kind of this undercurrent of sadness, which sometimes is very pronounced, as it is in The Graduate, and sometimes is really subtle, as it is in Working Girl, because mostly Working Girl is an upbeat movie. It's a movie of the 80s. It's a year after Wall Street, and it very much embraces that kind of, you know, up-and-coming working girl in kind of corporate America. But when that movie ends and you see her in this tiny, nondescript office, and this is her great victory,
right. There
is, I refuse to believe that a guy who thought about things the way Mike Nichols did and a guy who had made The Graduate was unaware of the kind of ambivalence of watching that ending. And yes, it's a great victory and she's in love and she's happy, but at the same time, there's this...
Well, there's work left to be done.
Right. There are tensions and sadnesses in The Birdcage, which is this kind of big, over-the-top, goofy,
some of it has aged better than others.
Absolutely. Goofy kind of comedy, but there's a tension and a sadness to it. And I think one of the things he was really good at is teasing out those conflicts between kind of sadness and victory.
This is one of, what, 12 people who've won the EGOT?
Yeah.
You know, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. You know, this was an unbelievably versatile person, but I think it all comes out of this very warm, very sweet comedy.
Well, full episodes of Pop Culture Happy Hour are available every Friday on iTunes or from your favorite podcast provider or at npr.org. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Linda.